There we go. Welcome to the Solomon's Corner podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Roberts. Sorry for that delay. I got a warning right before I started that I was about to run out of disk space and that my show was going to be terminated right at the start of this thing, so I had to clean out some disk space. Anyway, today, Richard Dawkins says he's a Christian. Tom Holland discusses why he has started to reconsider Christianity, and Tammy Peterson joins the Catholic Church. Also, we have more questions about doctrine, miracles, and Catholic Church that have rolled in, and we will discuss. Finally, we close out the show discussing one of the best movies I have seen in a long time, and it's not woke, but it is Catholic. So, you know, since 90% of you guys are Protestant, you're just going to be like, oh, my word. Just stop drowning me in the Tiber. Anyway, sorry. Tough. Here we go.
Welcome to the Solomon's Corner podcast, a place for thinkers. Join us as we explore the depths of theology, philosophy, and the Christian intellectual life.
Now, I also have my wife here, who may or may not actually chime in. It just depends on how many comments we get. But she wouldn't go on camera. By the way, is there coffee in that crayon?
Seems like there is.
Okay. She's already acting awkward. There we go. Didn't even put her on camera yet, and she's already like, there it is. That's how she talks every day. Can you pour it?
I can't.
Are you going to bump it in?
No,
bump it into your mic again?
No, I'm not.
I bet you Bethel's going to be like, oh, Lindsay.
Doesn't know how to
So glad
coffee.
You're here. Don't let your husband make fun of you on the air. Anyway. All right. So, yeah, we're going to dive in here with some crazy stuff that happened if you were in the apologetics world at all. The God delusion continues to get more delusional. It seems as it goes on. I'm going to take this hard drive out of here. There we go. And so Dawkins came out this past week. Richard Dawkins, the guy who wrote The God Delusion, you know, calls himself an atheist, but anybody who's read his stuff, he's technically an agnostic because he says you can't know for certain that God doesn't exist. Which, you know, at least he's intellectually honest. Can't prove a negative and all that. But before we talk about that, I want to talk about this interview that British apologist, English apologist, I guess you would say, Justin Briley. I haven't really listened to much of his stuff. I have some friends on Twitter who have gone on his show and whatnot, but he's across the pond, so the accents are great. That, you know, you always feel like a smart Christian when, you know, you feel like we're winning whenever you hear a British person talk about Christianity. But he had a conversation with another Englishman named Tom Holland, not to be confused with the web slinger. And Tom Holland, the historian, again, not Spider-Man, although with great power does come great responsibility, as Tom Holland discusses. But he's talking with Justin at this event, and they're talking about, you know, is there a uptick in the belief in God? So it's just kind of funny that these two clips ended up dropping, like, in this order. So I'm going to play them to you in the order I saw them on Twitter, and also chronologically the way that they dropped into the Twitterverse.
What's your thesis? And maybe you could start with Matthew Arnold, The Sea of Faith, and a bit about the rise of new atheism.
Well, in a way, I tried to summarize the thesis of the book in its subtitle, which is why new atheism grew old and secular thinkers are considering Christianity.
That's Justin Briley on the left. Well, I don't know what it is for you guys because sometimes the mirror is off, but he's the guy with the, you know, kind of like frosted tip look of hair, you know, for those kids who grew up in the, you know, 2000s. Tom Holland's the one over on the right.
Again, but yes, in the introduction, I reference a well-worn line from the Victorian poet Matthew Arnold from his poem Dover Beach, where he talks about in his age the melancholy long withdrawing roar of the sea of faith, which stood for the way in which secularism, science arguably, was sort of taking the place of religious belief in his generation. And 150 years on, you could say that's only accelerated in the West. But I suppose the catalyst for me writing about a rebirth of belief in God actually began sort of with a conversation I was hosting when I was hosting The Unbelievable Show with Douglas Murray, who's a sort of quite well-known thinker, opposite New Testament historian Tom Wright. And it was actually Douglas Murray who said, referencing this line from Matthew Arnold, Well, the thing about the sea of faith is that it could come back in again. That's the point of tides.
What's your thesis?
So one of the things that he's talking about there is there actually a revival? Now, the thing that I think is happening is that there might be a Catholic revival, but we have to distinguish that from a mass revival, not to be confused with the, you know, Latin mass or the Catholic mass. You know, just because there is a revival doesn't mean that it's going to necessarily become the majority, but it could end up increasing significantly. And I know at our parish, I was shocked. You know, the Easter Vigil, we went to one last year at a church in South Carolina, and then we went to one this year in Ohio. And both were various sized churches, but they were decent sized churches. And the Easter Vigils, though, all had standing room only. And this is a 3-hour service that happens at night. And then I looked on Twitter and I saw that a guy in North Carolina had 1,100 people confirmed in his diocese in North Carolina. Now, the reason why that's significant is because to become Catholic, you don't just get dunked and say you believe. Like, it's a process. So 1,100 people is a lot. And so this is, if you go on Twitter and you follow any Catholics, they're saying that this stuff is, it seems like there's a more people coming in to these churches that weren't there before. You know, the traditional view of like a Catholic church just being quiet and empty just doesn't seem to be manifesting as much as it used to. So anyway, he says this about the tides, and then Dawkins decides that he's going to say this. So maybe the tide is rolling in. Well, if there was a sign that the tide was rolling in, it might be that Dawkins says this.
I was slightly horrified to hear that Ramadan is being promoted instead. I do think that we are culturally a Christian country. I call myself a cultural Christian. I'm not a believer. But there's a distinction between being a believing Christian and being a cultural Christian. And so, you know, I love hymns and Christmas carols. And I sort of feel at home in the Christian ethos. I feel that we are a Christian country.
Okay. It's just weird that he would say he feels at home in the Christian ethos after literally calling everybody a bunch of delusional idiots. Just saying, it's just a little weird, you know. Anyway.
In that sense, it's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down. And I'm happy with that. But I would not be happy if, for example, we lost all our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches. So I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would matter if we, certainly if we substituted any alternative religion, that would be truly dreadful. I was slightly horrified to hear that.
He sounds just a little bit like a woman who can't make up her mind, in the sense that he says that he likes Christianity. He says that he doesn't like Christianity. He says that he would like to keep all of the nice things that Christianity has, but doesn't want the commitment of Christianity. So essentially he's saying he wants a Christian booty call. That's basically what he's saying. And so, you know, think about anybody. I mean, it reminds me of talking to, now that Lindsay's here, it's just kind of funny. It reminds me of talking to Lindsay about where she wants to go to eat, you know? And like, you know, Richard Dawkins is, it's like, where do you want to go to church, Richard? Oh, I don't know. I kind of like the gay one over here, but I really don't like this one over here, but they have the good carols. I just don't know, you know? But the point is that this obviously, I mean, if somebody like Dawkins is saying implicitly, oops, I may have, may have made a mistake in who I was going after, because I kind of thought that this atheist utopia was gonna jump in. Were you gonna say something? Did you want to contribute?
Oh,
defend
no,
yourself?
No. I mean, it's entirely true. Anytime that we try to go out to eat, this is why I just try and avoid going out to eat now. I just have become a great cook, so that way we don't have to talk about it, and I can control everything. So
there you go. As they say, you know. I don't know what they say, but I can't think of a comeback right now. Back to Richard Dawkins. There we go. So anyway, then, you know, Tom Holland, though, coming back to the Justin Brierley and Tom Holland discussion, they start to talk about the new atheist as a product of American evangelicalism or the Protestant movement. Not in the sense that American evangelicals created Richard Dawkins, but in the sense that that's the logical endpoint of Protestantism. And so we'll listen to Tom Holland and what he means by that.
So I think that the new atheists are palpably an endpoint in a Christian tradition. Richard Dawkins is, I mean, he is spreading good news. You know, he is an evangelist. And his good news is that if you get rid of superstition, then you will be a happier and better person. You know, you will be able to hear your conscience in a clear way that you wouldn't have been able to with the kind of the static that religion had provided. And that basically is the Reformation argument. I mean, that is Luther saying, get rid of all this nonsense and you will be able to hear the voice of the Spirit in your heart. So Richard Dawkins seems to me a logical endpoint for that. I think that I completely agree with Justin that that kind of confident evangelical atheism has crumbled and collapsed. I think it has so many kind of contradictions within it that it hasn't really been able to put down firm roots.
So I said that when I was in seminary, I had to read The God Delusion, and I remember thinking, you know, it's just weird to me that you would think atheism is going to be some kind of good news, or that you could even have a kind of atheism, as Dawkins says, where you get all the Christmas carols that are singing about a deity, and everybody knows that it's a joke. Like, that's the world he wants. He literally wants a world in which everyone is delusionally singing songs about something they all know is false. That's the world he wants to live in. This just seems to be a quintessential example of somebody who has followed their atheism to where it logically leads, and they don't like where it leads, and they're trying to hang on to that while simultaneously hanging on to all the good things, the true, the good, and the beautiful. They just don't want it incarnate. They want the true and the good and the beautiful to stay up here in their head, but they don't want it to be embodied. They don't want it to be enfleshed. So one of the things that's interesting before we go on is that, is the tide actually turning? Is Justin Briley actually correct? I don't know if I'm saying his name right, but is he actually correct that the tide is turning? And I think it is for Catholicism. And I think part of the reason why that is, and why these conversions do seem to be at least somewhat sincere, is because, you know, a lot of times, you know, growing up in the church, you'd hear stuff about somebody converting, you know, life of drugs, the life of this or whatever. And their Christian message was about, was largely around the idea of God make, it was either implied or explicitly stated that God made their life better. It was that's in some way it was an implicit prosperity gospel message. And there's good things that come with becoming a Christian. There's no doubt about it, whether that's, you know, coming into the Protestant church or coming into the Catholic church. The difference with the Catholic church is that while, you know, as we discussed Tammy Peterson's miracle, or we talk about Shia LaBeouf, or even Russell Brand, who I kind of question that one as more of a kind of chasing analytics. But the thing that is unique about their perspectives is that their outlook changes to, I have a cross to bear and Christ gives me the strength and the grace to do it, versus God took my burden off my back. And it's very clear from the scriptures that Christ says, if you're going to follow me, you got to take up your cross. And the thing is, when you come into the Catholic Church, depending on who your priest is or your deacon, it's just like every other denomination. It depends on who you got, you know, as far as to what you're going to get in terms of the accuracy of it. So you're still responsible for your own decision on that. But when you start to read the life of the saints, there is nothing about the life of the saints that makes you think, oh, well, that looks nice. There's no Joel Olsteins in the Catholic Church, you know, saints that you would read on the feast days or whatever. And I understand that there's, you know, legends and things like that. Like I saw one on Twitter that was like Saint Mermaid of the Pirates, you know, and it's kind of like, "Arr, Catholics, what do you have to say now?" You know, it's so that was going around from the Protestants. I thought it was pretty funny. But when you actually take seriously, like some of the martyrdom stories especially, there's just no way that you can come into the Catholic Church and think that, oh, my life is going to be easier. It'll be better, but not easier. And so I think that that is part of, you know, it's in line and in sync with the phenomenon of why people are coming in to the church. The other thing that I wanted to touch on too is this idea of the new atheism spreading the good news. There is an assumption, and we'll talk about it further on, that if you get rid of superstition, like Tom Holland said in that clip, if you get rid of superstition, you'll hear your conscience better. But the problem is that if you think about your conscience, it's a habit that's formed. If somebody has a lot of anxiety and they keep feeding that anxiety, they don't have a healthy conscience. If somebody does evil things repeatedly and they start small and they get bigger and bigger and bigger, eventually their conscience goes away. So the question is, okay, well, if that's the trajectory of the conscience, then how do we actually get it back? How do we come back from that? And the way that that happens is usually an encounter with the divine. And that is what happens. It doesn't have to be a capital M miracle, but it could be something that is highly subjective that leads to a objective truth. And so we'll look into that a little bit more. But before we do that, there's just one more thing to make clear as we continue this conversation, is that, you know, Michael Moles is the one who said this first, that I heard him say this first, which is, those who look for signs and wonders are foolish, but a foolish generation is the ones who don't recognize them. That's a paraphrase. He says it better than I do. And I think he got it from like a priest or a bishop or something. So it's even better from them probably. But it's important to understand that, you know, we're not Indiana Jones looking for the next big thing. But if we don't recognize when God is moving in our life, then we are going to take a harder road than what we should. And it will be harder, not because life itself is not difficult. It's going to be harder because you won't have the grace to endure. So Tom Holland continues and he says, you know, I'm not sure that the new atheists are having an impact. And this is the reason he says.
But I think that what certainly in Britain, I mean, maybe less so in the United States, but certainly in Britain, what we have now is a situation where most people simply do not know enough about Christianity or the Bible, even to be against it. Mm. Richard Dawkins and new atheists are always dropping verses from the Bible to prove that God is.
Oops. There's a hotkey. Hold on. We're going back.
But I think that what certainly in British people, even to be against it, Richard Dawkins and new atheists are always dropping verses from the Bible to prove that God is, you know, a genocidal tyrant or whatever, or that it's all nonsense or it doesn't accord with evolution or whatever you want to do. But people now, by and large, generations growing up, I think the mass of them, they don't know the Bible at all. They never read it. They have no familiarity, even with the most basic stories, the Good Samaritan or the Passion or Exodus or any of these things, David and Goliath, stuff that has been part of the mental furniture of people in this country, certainly for, you know, for 1,000 years and more. And that is a massive, massive change. Now,
so let me know what you think in the comments. You know, do you think he's right? Do you think that people don't actually have knowledge of the Bible anymore? I definitely think that is true. In fact, I was looking at my analytics and I was surprised to see that actually most of my audience is between like 20 and like 45. I expected, no offense, youngins, but I thought that they would be a little older. So, but I do think that he's right, that you are starting to see that there is just a basic biblical illiteracy. The stats bear this out across Catholics and Protestants. They've both done their own studies on their own primary doctrines, and they see an illiteracy about what they believe. You know, there was a famous one that was done in like the 2010s or something like that by the Barna Group, and things appear to have only gotten worse. And this leads to a question: is okay, well, what are they going to actually? What's actually going to bring them back? And I think that it's going to be religion. I don't think it's going to be arguments or you know, rhetoric or any of those kinds of things. I think that what we're seeing is that the evangelistic landscape is changing. And what they're going to look for is signs in the real world, like beauty, not miraculous signs necessarily, but beauty. And they're going to look for holy places. They're going to look for places where they can be alone, where they can be in a quiet place. Tom Holland, I don't have the clip, but he does say later on that when he was doing his research for Dominion, the book that he wrote on church history, that He likes the fact that when he's in a church, he doesn't want to turn on his phone. And this is also a fad that Daily Wire covered a couple weeks ago, that there was a TikTok trend of young people going into not, you know, congregationalist drums and loud churches, but into old churches, quiet churches, where it's just quiet, like you can hear a pin drop. That's what it's like when you go to our Catholic church during the week. It's like you walk in there, it's absolutely dead silent, and there's just people praying in there. It's one of the most beautiful things you'll ever see. So I think that it's not that those seeking a miracle will find nothing. It's that I think that people are going to be looking for something. Like they might, you know, be looking for some sort of supernatural sign. But if you're just looking for a miracle, that's what I mean to say. If you're just looking for a miracle, then your faith is going to be pretty shallow, because miracles can't, you know, you have to check your desire. If the issue is, well, I want a miracle so that I can know the truth, well, God may not give you one because he wants you to have faith. And so the thing is that but those who are seeking salvation, I think those will be the ones to find the grace and to bear their cross. And this isn't some sort of reverse psychology that you play on God, where you're like, you know, God, I don't want a wife and I'm happy, and therefore I'm ready for you to give me a wife. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that the heart attitude does actually come into account. And part of that is, recognizing that you're the only one who knows your intention. So as we look at the rest of the question, you know, is there going to be a revival? You know, miracles aren't enough, and miracles only happen because they're ultimately to get you to the next step in God's plan for your life. They're not meant to, you know, be something that you've got, you know, plastered on your wall and that you brag about to your friends or those kinds of things. So I want to keep going here, though, and talk about Tom Holland's experience. So last week we talked about, or a couple weeks ago, we talked about Tammy Peterson. She's now in the Catholic Church, and we'll look at Jordan Peterson's response at the end of the show. But Tom Holland's, you know, kind of unexpectedly at this, at least from what it looked like on Twitter, decides that he's going to, they ask him, where are you at in this whole process? Like, you seem to be an ally for Christianity, you seem like you have a lot, you want Christianity, you're like Dawkins, like, but even more friendly now. You know, Dawkins is kind of friendly now, but Tom Holland actually wants like Christianity way more than Dawkins does. And so, you know, he's almost like a defender of it. In fact, Justin Brierley talked about a podcast that they did where it was between two atheists, and Justin said that Tom Holland's defense of Christianity was great, but Tom Holland's not a Christian. So that's where that question is coming from. And so Tom Holland begins to talk about his experience in a Iraqi church while they were doing a documentary on the persecution of Christians over there for another research project he was doing.
So we ended up in this place, and it was incredibly hot. There was a kind of stench of death hanging over it. There was ruins everywhere. There were, you know, tripwires and bombs, and you know, it was awful. And the admiration I feel for war correspondents who keep going back to these kind of places over and over is off the scale, because I will never go back to somewhere like that. But there was a church.
So I just want to highlight this, that this is not like he went up the road. I mean, he is in a very dangerous place when this happens. And that'll be important in a minute.
I went to this church. It had been built by Armenian refugees from the genocide in the Ottoman Empire. And then they'd come here, and then fresh genocidal enemies had turned up. So they've had a very bad run. And in this church, the Islamic State fighters had demolished the altar with power drills, and they had toppled over the font, and they had pulled down all the icons and smashed them and jumped up and down on them. And I saw, amid all the kind of the rubble and the broken glass, there was this kind of piece of paper, card that had been left. And I picked it up, and it was a picture of the Annunciation. So the great wings of Gabriel sweeping backwards as he knelt before the Virgin. And I felt that I could, I felt it was a kind of one of those thin places that people talk about where the dimension of the heavenly suddenly seems incredibly close. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk in this vein in a congregationalist church.
He is saying he's sorry because he is in Martin Lloyd Jones's church, where Martin Lloyd Jones preached for 30 years. Martin Lloyd Jones was a Protestant preacher. I only know him by name. I probably screwed up his name, but I mean, he was very well known back in the day, and many Christian public influencers mentioned his works and stuff in their sermons and stuff. So he was not a friend of Catholicism.
But it's going to get worse. But it felt incredibly vivid, and I kept that image. And I was in a place where people had been crucified, and a sense of what that meant to be, you know, 2 miles away, to have people who had thought as the Romans had thought, that execution and crucifixion were ways of upholding their power, that's the power, that's the signification the cross had for these people, not as a symbol of the power of the weak over the strong, but the opposite, power of the strong over the weak. And it was, you know, it was a kind of existentialist abyss opened up before me. And so I think I was, for that reason, very open to the sense of angels' wings brushing overhead in this desecrated church. I mean, I was dehydrated. I was in a mess. I mean, I can come up with all kinds of Dawkins-esque reasons why I felt like this. But it was a very vivid, real feeling to me, and I kind of cherish it. And then...
So, the... And just keep in mind, I got to pull up my slides back and forth. I only got one monitor here. One of the things to keep in mind about this experience, because I got a question over the weekend, was it over the weekend? I think it was over the weekend, about, you know, how do we determine, you know, should we listen to Benny Hinn then if miracles are true? The quality of miracle does depend on the context of the situation. For example, we don't sit here and we don't say, you know, and I'll answer this question in more detail, but we don't sit here and say when we talk to missionaries, for example, of any stripe, the things that happen overseas are often just verbal, like just word of mouth. You know, there's no written document or anything. The missionary comes back to the churches, talks about all the great things God has done, this or that thing that was unbelievable, and you know, they had this many baptisms or they had this many professions or whatever denominational missionary is coming back to report from the field. Nobody questions those things. In fact, they'll give money as soon as they hear them. But the moment an atheist influencer who is suddenly having what they call an encounter with the divine, many Christians are skeptical of it because they are looking at it and trying to determine, well, what doctrines does your testimony implicitly confirm or deny? And so we'll come back to that. But one of the things that I think is really, really important here is that he says, I can rationalize it. I could rationalize it. We kind of get on some of the people in Jesus's time as if like, oh man, alive. I mean, Jesus is right there and you don't believe, you know, if I saw that, I would have believed. But the thing is that most of the miracles were relayed to the Pharisees or the Sadducees a lot of times, by word of mouth. Take the blind man, for example, who Jesus heals and sends back to the temple to present himself. Well, the Pharisees are like, well, wait a second, like, you know, has he always been blind? You know, they start interrogating the persons or whatever. You know, this happens. You know, people fake things all the time for attention. You know, I mean, like, how many times have we seen a book deal or whatever because somebody said that their kid went to heaven and came back, you know, or whatever, and, you know, they make movies about it, and there's a lot of incentive to do these things, right? Because everybody knows that a miracle in some sense confirms the speaker as having some sort of secret knowledge that the rest of us don't have, you know, what was revealed or whatever. Well, a good indication of whether or not somebody is, you know, speaking some sort of divine truth or not, is by doing so, are they going to suffer more or are they going to be rewarded more? That's a good, just a rule of thumb. It's not a doctrine, but, you know, like becoming Catholic is, or becoming Christian in any sense, not to imply that Catholics aren't Christians or Protestants are Christians, but if you're going to convert to Christianity, and you're going to do it and adopt all the teachings of the Catholic Church, which is what you say at your confirmation, your life's not going to get easier. It's going to get harder. But if you just go around and say, yeah, I did this, you know, we all know scam artists are there. But more on that later. But one thing to point out that is an interesting pattern is that in the Protestant history and in the and in communist history, and then also, you know, as he mentioned there in Islam, the attack on icons is a very interesting parallel across all three of them. The communists would go in and destroy churches and, you know, destroy imagery. If you read, and they'll do this even with historical icons, not just religious ones. If you read Mao's America by Xi Zhanfleet, she talks explicitly about the fact that one of the things that convinced her that Mao was wrong was by coming over to America after several years, like 20, 25 years of brainwashing in Mao Zedong's China. She came over to the United States and she still struggled to let go of her communism because it was hard to find a job. And she thought Mao's actually right. And one of the things that helped her understand that Mao was wrong, according to her book, was the fact that people had preserved statues of like Abraham Lincoln and Benjamin Franklin and George Washington, and their houses had been preserved. And she has a section in her book dedicated to thanking the people who preserved these historical sites because she could touch them and feel and see that Mao was wrong. This is one of the reasons why whenever you conquer a group of people culturally or militarily, you go through and you destroy the symbols of the previous culture. This is just what people do. And so when we look at communism, they did that. Protestants did that. In fact, if you read this book by an Anglican called the Anglican Spiritual Tradition, there is a great first 30 pages in that book about the challenges of being a Catholic priest during the oscillation back and forth between the different theological positions in the royalty and how it was impacting rural churches. And you know, first they got to throw out all their icons, then they can bring them back, and then they got to destroy them, and then they got to bring them back. And so then I believe it's Queen Elizabeth comes in and comes up with this, you know, Catholic liturgy, Protestant theology kind of approach. And that's the Anglican Church. Now, when we come back to, you know, Islam, they're doing the exact same things. They're taking down the altars, they're destroying the icons, they're doing all these crazy things. And you know, the thing to keep in mind about Catholic churches, Lindsay was actually reading this to the kids this morning, so correct me if I'm wrong, but that what this book she was reading to the kids said, you know, Catholic cathedrals are supposed to be like walking into the Bible made of stone and glass. And I have a personal story with this. You know, my kids, when we were in the Anglican church, there was this scene, and I think I've told this before, but there was this scene of the gospel, the Stations of the Cross, essentially, on the wall in stained glass windows. It was a high Anglican church, and my daughter was only 4 years old, and everybody understands that kids like images more than words as they're younger, and then as they get older, the word becomes more powerful. I mean, the spoken word, not just, you know, theological words. And she is looking at the window and she says, "Dad, that's the gospel." And she was four. And, you know, I had no idea that she, or maybe she was five. I can't remember exactly. Do you remember her age roughly at that point?
Yeah, she would have been four.
Yeah. So she was like 4 years old. And I remember realizing in that moment, cause I'm, you know, my kid was asking questions at four and I asked questions at four. You can ask my mom. It's true. And so I was kind of surprised that these images were what had really helped solidify what I had told her. And so, the thing that I think has to happen if there's going to be a revival, that is that, especially, you know, amongst the churches, it's going to have to be a beautiful revival. It's not going to be enough to just be a propositional one, like, hey, you know, if you believe in Jesus, you know, we'll baptize you right now, you know, and there's no beauty, there's no art, there's nothing, there's no evidence of man trying to bring heaven to earth to a certain extent. And I don't mean that in the Tower of Babel sense, so, you know, don't get too excited over there. He continues, he has this thing, and he comes back to the United States, Tom Holland does, and he goes through what happened after he has a cancer diagnosis. And he says that, you know, basically there's no atheists in foxholes.
And Christmas Eve came, and there was no, you know, they didn't tell me. And
important context here, he is diagnosed with cancer during COVID, during like an Omicron spike or something like that. And so, you know, his hospital was overrun, apparently, and they couldn't get him his test results and stuff. And he had already been diagnosed. But that part of the story was fairly long. And so I cut that. But that's what happened. So he's got this diagnosis where they're saying they're going to have to remove like 3/4 of his gut, and it could have spread everywhere, and they don't know what to happen, but, you know, they're going to try and get the results back as fast as possible.
I can't blame them, because I knew that they were overwhelmed. I mean, it was the worst kind of time to be having this kind of treatment. And so, but I felt kind of, oh, Lordy. So I went to Midnight Mass at Bart's that Christmas Eve, and at the end of the service, I looked over to where the Virgin...
He's talking about St. Bartholomew's Cathedral, I think it is. That is where it's a 900-year-old church, and it's apparently the only place in London where the Blessed Virgin has appeared. And he looks over, and he sees where they claim that she appeared.
It appeared. And I thought, well, might as well give it a go. You know, there's no atheist in a foxhole. What have I got to lose? So I went, and I haven't prayed. I mean, I haven't, you know, when I was young, and I thought, I've got to pray for everyone or they'll die. And I remember that kind of nervousness as a seven-year-old, thinking, who have I left off? I don't want them to die. And I hadn't really prayed since then. But I went to this place where the Virgin had appeared, and I gave a heartfelt prayer, you know, come on, please. And all kinds of things went right from that point on. And I won't go into the details, but basically, it seemed miraculous that in the most unexpected way, I not only got access to the photos, which told me that I didn't have cancer in the lymph nodes, but also I found out that I didn't have cancer. The cancer hadn't spread from the polyp, and that therefore I didn't need to have this chunk of the gut removed. And 2 years on, I seem clear of it. So I dodged a massive, massive bullet there.
So this gets into, okay, well, how do you actually understand the relationship between the subjective and the objective? And I think a story, and I'll try and tell it as quickly as possible. I think I've still got like 20 minutes left before I decide to sign off. But, you know, one of the things that happens here is that, you know, we can, you know, when I played the Tammy Peterson rosary stuff, you know, last week, you know, people have talked to me about that and had different takes on it and things like that. But it is interesting that the more anti-Catholic you are, the more Dawkins-esque you sound. And the more friendly you are to Catholics, the more Tom Holland someone sounds like. Well, you know, God can do what he wants, you know, whatever, but, you know, that's just not for me. This would not be a serious issue as long as it wasn't the case that God claimed that he is the truth, the way, and the life, meaning, you know, like, no one comes to the Father except through him. And so the way we approach these things have to be with some level of openness in order for us to judge them according to at least our conscience to the best of our ability. But there are some people who will have experiences where they will be more accountable to others than because of the experience they had than others will be if they didn't have that experience. So I'll give you an example. What I mean by that is that that when God moves in our lives, he does it in a way that he knows will force you to make a choice. It's not one that's irresistible. That just isn't how it works. The main thing is that he's going to get you where he wants you to be. And he's going to do it not in the way that is the most aligned with omnipotence, but the way that is most aligned with divine wisdom. In other words, he has to make sure that when he moves in your life, that he doesn't violate your identity or destroy your person. He has to make sure that it's you who is working with his grace. And so he in his divine wisdom can do that. It's the same idea around the incarnation. Did Jesus have to come in the way that he came? Well, logically speaking, no. But it's theology is not looking at the extremes of divine attributes and then calculating out some sort of theological application. Like, well, if God is omnipotent, then he doesn't need me to go to confession because he can just boom right there. You know, if God is omnipresent, then me going and receiving the Eucharist is no different than me going out in the trees. Well, the problem is that those approaches to God and to the way of living the Christian life is ultimately the lowest standard possible based on a hypothetical of how God acts rather than the way God chose to act. So if you're a Christian, you know that he chose to come born of a virgin and was fully God, fully man. Like, but that seems a lot harder for people to accept. And so the question is, okay, well, how's he going to get somebody like Daniel to accept that? Or how's he going to get somebody like Tom Holland to accept that? Or Tammy Peterson to accept that? Especially if there's only one church, one true church. He's going to have to do it in a way that removes the obstacles and allows them the freedom to choose. And so the way that this happened in my life in a non-theological context, but in the context of marriage, was that my parents' story of how they met overlapped with the way I met my wife. And the way that this happened, and the reason why I say this is because anybody who has met my wife is like, how did you find her? What happened? What's your story? Because she's so nice and so sweet and all those kinds of things. And I always say, well, if you lived with her, you might have a different perspective. But but she's a blessing. She's a blessing. So let me just take a drink of my vodka here.
Hold on. I'm just gonna pull from Scott Hahn here when he said that his wife, that he loved so much because she's such an optimist, he still said that she was his cross to bear.
Yes, that's true.
So, you know,
but they're a nice cross to bear. So, you know, they're friendly.
I'm an optimistic cross to bear.
That's true. Yep. It could be worse, she says, as she breaks my back. Anyway, so the thing is that my mom wanted a man with a big Bible. And so we would joke as young perverted kids, like, yeah, okay, mom, yeah, big Bible, whatever. And she would, you know, be like, what are you talking about? And we, you know, because my mom's a godly woman. And so those jokes just kind of didn't land. But anyway, so we would joke about that. And for years, I mean, we joked about this all the time. And when I was in college, a lot of my friends would ask me, so like, why don't you have a girlfriend? What are you waiting for? And I'd say, well, I'd like a good looking, nice Christian girl. And they'd say they don't exist. And I would say, well, I think they do. And I'm waiting for one of them. And I found one, and her name's Lindsay. But the way that I came to the conclusion that I still remember when I realized, like, I think she's going to be the one I'm going to marry, was not because she checked every box on my list, but because of the fact that, and I did have a list, you know, full disclosure, because that was what I was advised to do. And by my parents, it worked for them. And so I was like, well, they have a good relationship. I'm going to do that. And I have a good relationship. It works. You just need to make sure that you like whittle it down to like, you know, a Twitter post, you know, don't go like with 30. That's what I did when I was in high school. I had like 30 things, you know, it's like a Christmas list, checking it twice, you know.
Yeah, he did not find me.
No, I did not. So. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess my list meant that my first list was a naughty person. So anyway, but then, you know, I trimmed it down to like, you know, Christian, you know, athletic and, you know, wants to have a family or something like that. I don't know. What I like what I got. I can't remember what the list was. but anyway, you know, it's kind of when you have a car that's lasted forever. You're like, I don't remember where I got this thing, but man, it was a deal and the salesman was great. So what ended up happening is that Lindsay and I were talking and she said, hold on, my phone's ringing. I gotta find this thing. And she, you know, reaches into her purse and I'm like, yeah, that's fine, you know, whatever. And you know, there's a lot of things that check the box. Like she had a commitment ring, I had a commitment ring, you know, she was a Christian, I was a Christian. We even talked about like kids on the first day. She was like, man, I would love to have a family, like big one, you know, that'd be great. And then her phone rings. And I'm sitting here going like, okay, she's a nice girl, you know, whatever. Now, keep in mind that I had this image in the back of my head of you know, that I didn't realize was there, of my parents and what they said they had looked for in each other. Mainly this big Bible story that was constantly there. And she reaches into her purse and she's digging around. She can't find it. So she pulls out this big, huge Bible. It's like massive. And it's worn and used, and clearly it shows. And I remember exactly how she held it up and exactly what it looks like. NIV College Study Bible and their Student Study Bible. And, you know, you're right here. I'm waiting for her to be like, no, it wasn't. It was actually pink and unicorns and all this.
I'm trying to have some self-control. Yeah, I was about to say it was a Student Study Bible, not a College Study Bible.
Yeah, yeah. I felt you whispering. See what I said? Yeah, optimist, but also rebellious. So anyway, don't let Timothy Gordon hear this podcast. He'll be like, you need to shut that woman up, you know? But anyway, you know, I look and I'm like, oh my word. And immediately I think of my parents' story. Now, if I were to tell you, you know, yep, and then we went to the chapel and got married and we've been, you'd probably be like, well, that's a little weird, but that is what happened. I'm just kidding. That's not what happened. But in that moment, I went back to my, you know, dropped her off and I went back to my apartment and, I called my dad like that week and I said, Dad, I think I've met the person I'm going to marry. And, he said, well, you should propose. Cause my dad proposed after 2 weeks. And I said, I can't do that, Dad. You know, it's a different time, you know, all those kinds of things. But the reality was that was the indication that I should follow this path wherever it leads. And this is what happens with people. And this is what Tom Holland is describing right here. He's saying the way that these things aligned in such a way was so unique to who I was that's what made me wonder if it was the divine. It wasn't some Benny Hinn, you know, miraculous event that was, you know, whipping people with a towel and a jacket. It wasn't comical. It was incredibly private. There was no salesman there for Christianity. And this person has an experience where we have to understand that, like, this is what they did. This is what happened. And the thing is we can look at those events and we can say, well, they didn't happen because of X, Y, and Z. We can approach it as Dawkins, or we can approach it the way that the people who said, you know, I believe helped my unbelief, and see where it goes. And so he continues talking here.
As a Protestant agnostic, the idea that I had a Marian intervention seemed to me so sublimely funny. I thought, well, I mean, if it's true, God has the most wonderful sense of humor. And I kind of like the idea of a God with that kind of sense of humor. And I hug to myself the thought that I've been touched by something that utterly transcends every prejudice that I would have against the possibility of it happening. You know, not just that it is supernatural, but that it is, I mean, essentially kind of medieval Catholic. I mean, everything that I would view myself as not being. And God, so funny. I mean, you know, what a trick to pull. And so I'm in a kind of liminal space.
So pray for Tom Holland, because he's obviously wrestling with God at the moment. Maybe you should read Jordan Peterson's book. But anyway, it's coming out later. It's a free plug, Jordan. If you see me, reach out. Let's do an interview. Anyway, but the main thing is that when you look at this story, and this is why I think it's important, is that we have to understand that God does break into people's lives. And he does break into people's lives oftentimes that are public figures, because they're sometimes the best ones in order to cause other people to sit there and say, well, wait a second. Like, why would God do that to this person? Like, this person's story is, that's really interesting, you know? And at the end of the day, this is what happens with St. Paul. St. Paul is on the road to Damascus. He's a educated individual, and God breaks into his literal vision and blinds him. And again, these are all encounters with God that, you know, we can interpret them how we want. We can say, ah, no, you know, it was just dehydration, Tom, and all those kinds of things. And in fact, in a earlier clip, Tom says, you know, he talked to professional Christians, basically, and all of them kind of were just like, huh, okay, yeah, that's interesting. You know, that's weird. And I'd be curious to know how many of them were Catholic and how many of them were Protestant. Because I know plenty of Catholics who would hear this and be like, whoa, what? Like, that is crazy. And they just jump right into the miracle territory. Definitely the case. And there's no way that this one, in my opinion, is nearly as explicit of a miracle as Tammy Peterson's. I mean, I know plenty of people who have watched the Tammy Peterson testimony and said, yeah, that one I don't have a place for in my worldview. I need to think about that. But Justin Brierley closes out the event with this clip here on the fact that we are coming into a time where imagination is going to have to be the primary beachhead, so to speak, where Christians actually launch their evangelistic efforts.
I think there's a few things. I think, as I said earlier, I think the imagination is really important. It's important to engage that. And my fear is that if we try to too much present Christianity as just a very sort of follow this formula and sign on the dotted line at the bottom, that might work for some people, but for a lot of people, you've got to start somewhere else than at that sort of head place. And for me, it is about connecting with people's heartfelt kind of desires and longings and emotions. And I think, you know, a brilliant example of this was C.S. Lewis, because he was very good at doing the rational apologetics. He did that with, you know, Mere Christianity and The Problem of Pain. But what we all really remember C.S. Lewis for is the Narnia stories and the way in which they created a world that people wanted to exist, where, you know, who hasn't knocked on the back of a wardrobe just to check if there is a land of talking beasts and this wonderful wise but not tame lion who rules it and banishes winter and, you know, good overcomes evil. And the point that Lewis made, even in the books, was, well, what if that world really does exist? And there, Lucy, you'll know him by a different name. So I think it's about returning to that imaginative core of Christianity, not sort of just assume, not letting the atheist basically set the terms of the conversation.
And I agree with that statement. The question is, what doctrine do you have that permits this kind of imaginative approach? If you were to take Pilgrim's Progress, for example, my wife and I have talked about this several times, that it feels more Catholic than it was now that we are Catholic than it does Protestant when we were Protestant. And, you know, the reason why I think some of this is the case is that the closer you get to Catholicism, and you see this with Luther too, he didn't want to, like, get rid of everything, but he did still have an appreciation, for example, for Mary. In fact, all the reformers, for the most part, still had an appreciation for Mary. They all thought she was a perpetual virgin, for example. And, you know, there is this, the closer you get, the more beautiful Christianity gets, you know, the cathedrals and the, there is no doubt that the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church have the most beautiful churches in the world. No, bar none. And the reality is that Justin is right, but look at the church that they're in. There's a drum set there. They're sitting where the word of God, the thing that's most important to them, is supposed to be preached. And they're doing a casual interview. And I can remember, and I've said this before to people as we were coming into the Catholic Church, I can remember being a young kid running around in my Baptist church and remember being told, do not run in here. It's a sacred place. It's a place that you are supposed to be respectful and reverent. Now, I was young at the time. I didn't understand where that concept came from. And then I became Catholic. And I was at a parish where the priest was adamant that we be silent in the presence of God because they believe they have the actual body, blood, and soul and divinity of Jesus there in the Eucharist. And in the same way that Catholics took pews from the Protestants, sacredness and sacred spaces and reverence came from the Catholics because they were the ones who started this. You didn't have the Reformation until after, and even the Eastern Orthodox, they came out 1,000 years. And they still have reverence. But now we've lost our reverence. You know, Jesus is basically your buddy. He's not the king of the universe who decided to slay evil with a cross, but by death. I remember talking to somebody when I worked in a running store. They came up to me and they said, hey, what are you, so you work here, like, what are you doing? When like what brought you to the area and this kind of stuff. And I had moved there for seminary and we had just talked about theophanies, these ideas that they were, you know, manifestations of Christ in the Old Testament, but not incarnations. Norman Geisler actually helped me with that. He said, you know, manifestation is temporary and incarnation is permanent. And so these manifestations are happening. And I remember talking to her about how our class had just talked about whether or not the pillar of fire, when the angel of the Lord comes down in the pillar of fire between Israel and Egypt at the Red Sea. I remember talking to her and realizing that I had to change my perspective on Jesus because he was someone who loved me, but he was somebody to be feared. And that he was a warrior king, that he was somebody who was going to fight for his people. And she broke down and into tears and just started crying. And she gave me like an extra tip. She bought like $200 pairs of shoes and she gave me even extra money. I mean, we didn't even have a tip jar. And she said, you know, you have no idea how much I needed to hear that. The thing is that if we don't have doctrine that allows for the imagination to run, then you're going to end up with basically mysticism and Gnosticism over here where everybody makes Jesus in their own image. And they don't have any authority, so they just bark at everybody about how they're wrong because their interpretation of the scripture doesn't line up with theirs. And so you're sitting in the cafes and you guys are just fighting it out, duking it out, but there's no authority to judge between you. Or you end up with a hyper-rationalist approach to Christianity where you're in a maybe congregationalist church with an elder board or a deacon board, and the people who intellectually cannot argue theological points end up getting in trouble because they either don't have the time or they lack the intellectual ability to study the Bible and make their case effectively. Whereas if you're in a proper church where there is liturgy, there is ways to worship and Christ is truly present there, then it doesn't matter what phase of life you come from. Everybody can kneel before the king. Everybody can kneel and adore the king. And you have something to say?
Yeah.
Hold on, my wife is interrupting me in a moment where I really felt like I was driving it home, but that's well, okay. That's okay.
I'm about to bring up
next episode, submission. I'm just kidding.
I will not be present for that episode, I imagine.
Yeah.
No, I was just gonna say really quick, I think this is an example from G.K. Chesterton, but he basically says that being within the Catholic Church, it's kind of like being, it's like if you took a bunch of children and you put them on this island out in the middle of the ocean that's a huge plateau. So on every side is cliffs. And by being within the Catholic Church, there's a fence around the top of this island that is keeping everybody safe. And so the children have the freedom to explore and to enjoy all of the island space because of these safeguards. And so what happens when you take away part of the safeguard? Well, now the children are scared because they understand that there's danger now. There's not the safety net of this fence. And so now the children can't explore. They stay huddled in the center of this island and they're constrained in a way they're not supposed to be. And yeah. I just thought that was a beautiful metaphor.
When did you start reading G.K. Chesterton? You didn't tell me this.
Well, I didn't know it was G.K. Chesterton. I was telling another Catholic this example I'd read in some book, and he said, that's G.K. Chesterton.
Oh, okay,
I said,
gotcha.
Well, that makes right. sense, because that was a great yeah. idea.
So anyway, but that's the issue, is that if you don't have an authority with doctrine or sacred tradition, then you're either going to end up in rationalism over here, where only the most educated are able to lead the church, and those are the people that everybody's supposed to learn from, or you're going to end up over here with the Benny Hinn's and the mystics who tell you that, you know, they had a vision and you got to listen to them because they had the vision. There has to be doctrine that the miraculous is actually interpreted through. And from that comes the imaginative, the actual beauty and goodness and truth that's all wrapped up together in one. And so if you don't have those things, you're going to have a really hard time convincing somebody that Christianity is worth pursuing, especially given the fact that we are likely to end up in a time of persecution. We already are, legally speaking. Christians are already being targeted legally. Your apologetics and rational arguments are not going to be as compelling as the way you endure this. You know, what practices do you take to the gulag with you? How do you make sure that your Christianity is not merely an exercise of who has the strongest will, but who has the most faith? Faith is a habit. It is something that has to be exercised. It's something that has to be practiced. And God gives us these opportunities in order for us to attempt and to learn and to practice these kinds of things. But if all you have are rationalist arguments, all you have are, you know, whether you're Catholic or Protestant or whatever, if all you have is the rational, suffering is going to break you much faster than if you have an active prayer life that's informed by scripture, sacred tradition, and the saints. As my daughter wisely said, well, if you don't read the saints, how are you going to imitate Christ? Because they did it first. And so we've got this clip from Jordan Peterson. His wife just came into the Catholic Church. This episode's going way long, but we'll split it up into clips. And you know, we've got Dawkins at the beginning, we've got Tom Holland, we've got basically three agnostics, and all of them are centered around, you know, the idea of the one thing that would bring them all in would, I think, be a Marian apparition. If that actually happened, if you know, Tammy Peterson already did with the rosary, Tom Holland's having this prayer thing, Richard Dawkins loves Christmas carols. I mean, that is like peak Marian season. So, you know, Jordan Peterson says this:
unless we become as little children, we'll in no wise enter the kingdom of heaven. And I can see that happening to Tammy. And so it's great. It's great. It's ridiculously good.
But when you see how ridiculously good it is, what is stopping you from embracing the faith of your wife?
You mean all those pesky Catholics? I don't know if anything is stopping me.
What's holding you back? Unless
just watch this. Watch this. How he gets so stone cold here.
It's ridiculously good.
What is stopping you from embracing the faith of your wife?
Just watch all those pesky Catholics.
It's like, so funny. Stone cold. Boom.
I don't know if anything is stopping me.
What's holding you back?
I don't think anything's holding me back. Everybody's got their own destiny. And so,
is it in yours?
Is it in mine? I would say it's unlikely. But
why do you say unlikely?
I exist on the borders of things. So, why is that? I don't know, but that's how it is. So,
man,
when we interviewed Tommy yesterday, and
he is just, I'm going to stop right there because we're going late, but man, he is, it is just hard to watch that guy. God bless, you know, God bless him, but man alive, he is really wrestling with God. And again, like his wife, I mean, her story is hard for anybody to rationalize. But Alexis de Tocqueville, America's philosopher and France's Catholic, he said this: only minds freed completely from the ordinary preoccupations of life, minds of great depth and astuteness, can, with the help of ample time and attention, penetrate such vital truths. Such studies are quite beyond the average human capacity, and even when the majority of men were capable of such pursuits, they clearly would not have the free time. Fixed ideas about God and human nature are vital to the daily practice of their lives, but the practice of their lives prevents them from acquiring such ideas. And so Alexis de Tocqueville is essentially saying, you know, we don't have the ability to, for everybody to learn to the degree of Jordan Peterson. And this is back in 1836. You know, we, even with the internet era, we don't have the will for nobody. Not everybody has the will to want to learn to the level of Jordan Peterson, where they could say, well, if I was in his shoes, you know, I would be able to understand where he's come from. Nope. Jordan Peterson is having his experience. And for some reason, God is allowing millions of people to watch it. Millions of people. That's the other piece of the context here. Tammy Peterson isn't somebody who just walked in with a rosary and said, you know, I had cancer and I was healed on my anniversary and I'm the only one who survived. She is putting this out for public scrutiny, just like the resurrection of Christ happened. It was a publicly scrutinized thing. But even still, like, you and I did not see the resurrection happen. We've only seen lives change. Most of us have only seen lives change. We haven't even seen a miracle. And we believe. Why? Because we still believe that God is active today. We still believe that he moves in people's lives and that he is actually moving people to the truth. Not a truth that you have that I can't have because I believe this and you believe that, but that the truth is supposed to be the uniting factor. And so I think that the question, are we in a revival, is in some sense a prediction of Alexis de Tocqueville based on the political nature of America. He says here, one of the commonest weaknesses of human intelligence is the wish to reconcile opposing principles and to purchase harmony at the expense of logic. This is what every single one of the agnostics that we've talked about today is doing. It is not logical to sit there and say, I want Christmas carols, but not Christians. I want Christian culture, but no Jesus. You cannot have them. You cannot have it that way. You know, it's not Burger King. You know, have it your way. Is that Burger King? Yeah. Religion is not Burger King. Okay. You know, there's you know, you can get the Whopper your way, but you can't get Jesus your way. Okay. So my wife laughs at all my jokes.
Good
jokes. Yeah, it's true. I'm yeah. I wish Twitter would get on board. It's like, man alive, I dropped some hot tweets the other day and nobody's retweeting except for the bots. So, and we all know what that means. It's not a real woman, okay? So, anyway, he goes on. Therefore, there have always been and there always will be men, after submitting a certain number of their religious beliefs to a single authority, will seek to exempt several others and will let their minds hover at random between obedience and freedom. He goes on, but I am drawn to the belief that the number of those people will be, and by the way, those people isn't necessary. This is like page 520 and the other one's like 510. So there's a little bit of a contextual blunder there on my part, but just pointing that out. But he is talking about the people in democratic societies in all of these contexts. He says, I am drawn to the belief that the number of those people will be smaller in democratic times than in others, and that our descendants will tend increasingly to divide into only two parts, some leaving Christianity entirely and the others embracing the Church of Rome. And this is important because the question of revival is one that oftentimes is brought forward by evangelists and, you know, like Billy Graham and evangelicals and those kinds of things.
I'm also thinking even of the Asbury revival that happened last year.
Yeah.
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 Just kind of
I mean, it didn't necessarily put her out. I mean, people could have had an encounter with the divine there.
Yeah.
But the issue that that this presents is, what is the revival moving people towards? Is the revival actually moving people towards doctrinal truths that have been passed down from generation to generation to generation? Or is it just kind of a spiritualist Jesus? In other words, like, you know, someone I can pray to when I've got a problem, but someone I don't necessarily know how to worship. And this is really important because, you know, you tell me, you know, how would you define a Christian? You know, one of the things that happened to us when I started to convert to Catholicism that was very striking, that none of you recognized because you couldn't have, was the perspective that somebody is in when everyone is telling you not to be Catholic for different reasons, and those reasons contradict the other reasons that someone else is giving you. So person A says, you can't be a Catholic because of this Marian stuff. You know, you can't do that. You know, this is really, really important. You know, you can't do that. And then somebody else over here is saying, you can't be a Catholic because of sola scriptura. And this person over here is saying, you know, I don't believe in sola scriptura, but I don't believe in Mary. This person saying, I don't believe in Mary because of sola scriptura. And you're like, well, if I pick this person, I'm going to tell this person they're wrong still. If I pick the other person, I'm going to end up telling that person they're wrong still. I'm going to lose somebody in the process. And so as far as, like, you know, the motivation, the social motivation, it ends up diminishing pretty quickly, because once you embark on Catholicism, now just by virtue of you doing that, you're going to end up breaking communion with somebody. You're going to end, if you're taking it seriously from a doctrinal perspective, which if you do not care about doctrine, you probably aren't a Christian. It's just a fact. Because doctrine is what the faith teaches. It is the teaching of whatever church you're part of. And I would go as far to say that if you are in a position where you think that you get to decide what doctrine is for you personally, that's not the same thing as you getting to decide which doctrines you will submit to. You're gonna serve somebody. You're either gonna serve your own reason and your own definitions of Jesus, or you're going to look at what someone else has said and say, I'm going to submit to that. Either way, the one that is clearly safer according to scripture is to submit to someone else rather than to submit to self and then call it Jesus. That's a very dangerous position. And so I've told people, look, you know, maybe you're not ready to become Catholic. Maybe you're struggling. You know, we talked about this about Andrew Clavin too. You know, maybe, you know, he talked about the fact that, you know, he thinks that, you know, the homosexuality issue is not right or whatever. But the problem is that when you are sitting in a position, or not the homosexuality thing, it was whether or not Ben Shapiro should convert or whatever. There is not an Orthodox denomination out there that believes that you should not convert because it could be rough on your family. There's not a single one out there. There is also not a single denomination out there that will say that you personally get to decide what you believe and what you don't believe if you're going to be a part of their communion or a part of their ecclesial body, as the catechism calls them, I think, ecclesial community. That you will not find a body of believers that will say, yeah, you're fine to do that. You can believe whatever you want. They'll let you come to church. They'll let you visit. But if you say, hey, can I think whatever I want about this doctrinal issue that you have clearly stated in your bylaws, they will say, yeah, you can. And there's the door. You no longer need to serve on staff. And this isn't because they're bad. This isn't because doctrine is abusive. It's because whether you want to have a chess club or you want to have a church, you're going to have to define what that church is. Like, you're going to have to define what makes a member an active member of that church. You're going to have to do that, and that's going to be your doctrine. And so if you're sitting there saying, well, I'm not loyal to any church because ultimately the church is just universal and I don't have to do any of these kinds of things. Well, you know, that might work for a person who lives in the Amazon and has never heard of Jesus and has no idea what the word church even means. But for the person who's actively involved in these discussions and says basically what Ultron says in the Marvel Avengers movie, well, you know, there's no strings on me. Well, that's more of the demonic kind than it is of the divine. So anyway, we've got to wrap up here and get into some questions. And so I really need to get like a stinger here, and I just don't have it.
Also, I just wanted to make a great point here. You said that Ultron was the one that said there were no strings on him. And I would like to just say that I believe that was from Pinocchio.
No, Ultron says it and he's quoting Pinocchio.
No, I know. I was joking.
Oh, okay. All right. Listen here, woman. This is why women aren't supposed to speak in church, you know? Messing up the preacher. Sorry. All right. Anyway. So here's a question. I thought I heard you say, and I listened twice. Good job. That when there is a doctrinal question, that a miracle clears that up. I know that the Word of Faith people claim lots of miracles. Various faith healers proclaim lots of miracles. The Azusa Street Revival claim lots of miracles. So how does Matthew 21:23 fit into the business of miracles? Because according to Jesus' words, there will be people in hell who did all sorts of amazing things in the name of Jesus. Interesting. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Interesting that these people are workers of lawlessness, yet they proclaimed that they were working in the name and power of Jesus. Interesting. Yes, interesting. So, number one, I did not state that miracles clear up a doctrinal question. It's that miracles are meant to affirm doctrinal statements. So there's a difference. If somebody says, well, you know, I don't necessarily believe that Mary was a perpetual virgin. Okay, well, a miracle is not going to necessarily clear that up, because how would a miracle clear that up? But if somebody is saying, well, the intercession of saints is a efficacious doctrine that does lead to healings. Okay, well, are there any evidences of that? Well, yeah, there are. Tammy Peterson appears to be one. Tom Holland appears to be one. Apparitions appear to be claims of the Catholic Church. So you can test them, you can investigate them and see if they happen, in the same way that people investigate the resurrection. In fact, Trent Horn actually said, who's a Catholic apologist in a debate, said that because of the apparition of Fatima, which was, where was that again? Where was Fatima again? Do you remember?
Oh, golly. Portugal.
You don't remember?
No, Portugal. I think it's Portugal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, this apparition was recorded in newspapers. Crazy stuff happened, like 30,000 witnesses, apparently. So in that sense, we're closer to it. And Trent Horn said, yeah, well, you know, given our current context and how close we are to the original events, yeah, we probably have more evidences for Fatima than we do for the resurrection. But the thing is that the idea that, you know, you're going to compare somebody who's in distress in the hospital crying out to God based on their very limited knowledge of who he is and just what they know, and God honors that. He's not going to honor a lie. But the second thing is, you know, it's revealing that somebody might have an anti-Catholic bias if they're going to say that these two things are even similar and that this passage equates to it. I think one example, for example, of how people, you know, always throw these, yeah, you know, well, you know, if you're this guy, well, it depends on what lawlessness is. It depends on other factors in the Bible. For example, Jesus said, unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you do not have life in you. In fact, he doubles down and says you don't have eternal life. And there's only one denomination outside of the Orthodox, which, you know, that's a separate issue for another time. But, you know, the Catholics and the Orthodox are the only ones who claim it's the actual body and blood of Jesus. They're the only ones. And they've held on to that doctrine for 2,000 years. And so we have to incorporate interpretation into these things. You know, one other thing that came up as I was thinking about this question was, when I was in seminary and a Protestant, I heard many, many stories of pastors and missionaries who encountered the demonic. And they all came from different backgrounds. They all came from backgrounds of cessationism. I had a pastor who was a cessationist when I was a kid, and he did a whole series. He talked a sermon about how he was lifted up by one hand by a person who was demonically possessed. You know, weird stuff. Had another conversation with another guy from the SBC. He was in Louisiana. He saw somebody flipping over the pews who came in seeking for an exorcism. And, you know, they prayed it out. And then there was another guy who was in Cuba. He said, yep, saw it all the time. Now, one of those guys also said that he kept oil in his desk, not because he believed in the anointing of the sick, but because he would have sick people come, and as a pastor, he would anoint their heads with oil and lay hands on them and pray for them, because that's not a time to get into a doctrinal dispute, but we don't believe it anymore. Well, the Catholics do, and they actively still practice that. So the question is, okay, well, God's not going to lead somebody in a lie, but it's very interesting to me that, you know, Protestants will sit here and say, oh, like they all agree. Oh, yeah, that's demonic. Ouija boards, definitely demonic. Oh, yeah, like tarot cards, demonic. Yep, had a friend, demonically possessed. Yep, weird demonic thing. Somebody says, yeah, I love Jesus now, and I'm going to become a Catholic, and you know, I pray the rosary, and I'm ready to suffer for Jesus, and, you know, at the end of the day, you know, this life isn't all we have, and they're demonstrating the fruits that Jesus says. You know, they'll know you by your fruits. You know, judge rightly, Jesus says. But it's also important to note that this is stated before the New Testament is actually canonized. The New Testament will not be canonized for another 350 years, or, well, until the Council of Trent, really. But they don't start actually assembling this thing until 300 years plus. And so, you know, that's a long time. And even Protestants will say, well, yeah, we had oral tradition and these kinds of things. So it's important to understand that, like, you know, we have to understand we're not, just because somebody makes a miraculous claim, number one, doesn't mean that it happened. So we have to look at the effects first. We don't look at the claim, we look at the effect. If somebody says, I prayed a rosary and I'm the only one who survived cancer, that's not the same thing as somebody going to a Benny Hinn thing and saying, yeah, like, I felt warm and fuzzy all over and I'm pretty sure my cancer is gone. And then they go to the doctor and it's still there. And even if, let's just say that they actually go to the doctor and it's fixed, God can still do that. But it doesn't follow that all of a sudden, you know, that the doctrinal stuff that Benny Hinn or whatever is automatically true, because there are scammers all the time. So, which I think is what you're trying to get at here. But the bottom line is that you don't just use scripture and you don't just use sacred tradition. You have to have an authority that's going to adjudicate what is miraculous and what's not. What's permitted to believed as miraculous and what's not permitted to be believed as miraculous. But at the end of the day, claims happen all the time. But even Jesus was told that the reason why people knew he was the Son of God was because of the miracles that he did. So the question isn't, do miracles actually confirm the doctrine or this sort of statement or this church or that church? The question is, did a miracle actually happen? And then from there, we have to ask the question, okay, well, what would it entail? And so people will say, well, Protestants have miracles and Catholics have miracles, so I guess they're both right. Well, the difference is that if there's a Protestant miracle that happens, generally speaking, it's just affirming that God existed and that God heals and that he loves, which is exactly what the Catholic Church has. Even the Benny Hinns and stuff will say, you know, God loves you and he wants you to have a good life. And, you know, Catholics will say God wants you to have a life of abundance and all those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, when we're actually looking at the miracles themselves, like the resurrection, we know that the resurrection was what Paul said was the reason why we believe Jesus was who he said he was. So there's no question here about whether or not miracles confirm or deny doctrines. The question is why do you think the Marian miracles are, or why do you think that somebody praying a rosary is not a miracle? And that's a better conversation to have, rather than pulling up Benny Hinn and acting like he's the same situation. All right, moving on to the next question. If narrow be the way and few there be that find it, I think that's a Bible verse thing. Narrow be the way and few, the sentence is messed up. How do you reconcile being Catholic with the fact that it's the largest Christian denomination in the world? Well, Catholics don't believe that everybody's just going to make it in. You have to be a faithful Catholic. Mortal sin takes you out of a state of grace, and that's not a good situation for the salvation of your soul. And so the reality is that, yeah, like, I mean, denominational size doesn't necessarily mean that everybody in that denomination is actually saved, which I've heard is the position that every denomination, I've never heard a denomination not say that. You know, I've been to so many different denominational churches where pastors will say, you know, there's some among us who don't really believe. You know, and Catholics have the same situation. How many people go up and receive the Eucharist in mortal sin because they don't think it's the actual body and blood of Jesus? You know, like, or don't believe that mortal sin is actually really even a thing. Like, you basically have to murder somebody in order to come into mortal sin. Or, you know, somebody who's super scrupulous and thinks that, you know, I dropped a mug and so now I'm going to hell. At the end of the day, God is the one who's going to judge based on what people knew and what they did with that knowledge. And so being a Christian is hard. I mean, read He Leadeth Me. I mean, he denies the church, God, signs the papers, all these things in the gulag. You know, it's only by God's grace that he survived. Because if he had died in that state, you know, we can't say for certain where he would have ended up, but it wouldn't have been likely heaven. So the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, again, I would ask a Catholic priest on this one. I'm not a Catholic apologist. But I understand why friends of mine, especially since this started off as a Protestant podcast, would have questions about, you know, what I actually think about these things. But, you know, this is also where I think, you know, purgatory comes into play too. That, you know, people who were sincere in their beliefs, you know, and really sought Christ to the best of their ability. The Catechism says, while the sacraments do convey grace and are efficacious in their grace, God is not bound by the sacraments. And so it's ultimately God who decides who goes and who doesn't. And it's his prerogative. In fact, the Catechism says, you know, we know of no other way other than the body and other than Christ, other than Christ to enter the kingdom of God. This is a paraphrase, but that's what it says. But it doesn't follow that God couldn't, based on his divine wisdom and omniscience, that he couldn't allow somebody in because he's also just. And C.S. Lewis, who is, you know, he says this in The Last Battle, he has a character in there, and he says, you know, that ultimately this character is essentially a Muslim who decides that the false God that they're, well, I don't know, he could represent multiple characters, you know, if you know, let me know. But, you know, he ultimately fights the demon that's trying to deceive everybody. And he goes and he dies in the process of fighting this demon. And when the kids end up in Narnia's, in heaven.
Aslan's country.
Aslan's country, thank you. When they end up in Aslan's country, they see him there and they're like, how come he's here? And he doesn't even know why he's there. But he's happy that he's there. And I think this gets into also the idea of the rewards in heaven. You know, a lot of people don't talk about that, but there is going to be a hierarchy in heaven. Like, not everybody's going to have done as equally good of a job. So the best way to describe this is on the talents. When you have the five talents and the three, I think it's the two or three talents, and they multiply them in the one. And one of the things I say on this issue is, well, imagine if that was reversed. Imagine if the guy with one multiplied it to two and the guy with three or two or whatever it is multiplies his to four or six and the guy with five buries the five. Well, given the reaction that the master had with the guy with the one and burying it, you know, basically saying you're going to work this off and all this kind of stuff, it's like a bad deal. Is it any wonder that, you know, that the five person, the person who does the five, that he would not have a harsher judgment given what he had been given? And Christ says this very clear, to whom much is given, much more will be required. And to whom, you know, less is given, you know, less will be required. It's a paraphrase. But the bottom line is that this principle exists, that, you know, heaven isn't going to be like a Marxist utopia. Like, people are going to have done better jobs than others. Martyrs are a prime example of that. So I do not think that we have a lot of time left. I have gone way over. I'm going to work on doing that more, but we will talk about the movie review next week. If you want to go watch it beforehand, it's called The Miracle Club. It was a really good movie, very Catholic movie, but I highly recommend, and make sure you have a tissue with it. But I'll explain why I think that was a good movie later. But otherwise, I appreciate you guys being here and listening. I saw a lot of people coming in and out. And so you guys have a great week, and I will talk to you later. Keep thinking.